Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce Sanford Levinson, the author of An Argument Open to All, Reading the Federalists in the 21st Century. He's also written Framed and Our Undemocratic Constitution. He holds the W. St. John Garwood and W. St. John Garwood, Jr. Centennial Chair in Law and is Professor of Government also at the University of Texas at Austin. Has some very intriguing ideas, which is why we brought him here. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm absolutely delighted to be here and grateful to all of you who took the time to come. Let me begin, as many people are trying to do these days, by tying this to Hamilton, which my wife and I have had the privilege of seeing, and both of us, I think, agree with the New York Times that says it really is that good. The question posed by Hamilton, one of the many questions posed by Hamilton, which I've described to a number of people these days is the Moby Dick of the American musical theater, so it is full of different questions, is at some level what it's about. Is it a costume drama about the revolutionary and constitutional period that's certainly distinct because of the style, the rap, and those who are acting in it, but otherwise of no particular relevance to us today other than being just another costume drama, maybe similar to 1776? Or are there aspects of the play that have contemporary relevance? And that is the central question, really, of this book. If I were to change one sentence in the book, I realized very early on, after talking to students and my colleagues after publication, that the sentence on literally the first page, "The Federalist is, without doubt, the best known, most widely read, and analyzed extended work of American political thought." It is correct that it's the best known. It may be also correct that it's the most often analyzed. I have come to realize that it's simply false to say that it is widely read, that most of our students, most of my colleagues, have not read The Federalist in its entirety. There is a greatest hits aspect to The Federalist, that if people have read The Federalist, it's very likely to be numbers 10, 47, 51, and 78. And if you're a lawyer, I'm sure you've read number 78 because it valorizes the role of the courts. There are 85 essays in The Federalist. And as we learned from Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton wrote 51 of them, James Madison 25, and John Jay 5 of them. And they're really quite interesting. And I will say that I was mildly surprised. When I embarked on this project, I wasn't sure it was going to work, because the project really is to ask, is there any reason for very busy people in the 21st century who are not 18th century history buffs, or perhaps teachers in American political thought, to read all 85 of the Federalists? I've come to the conclusion the answer is yes, because these essays were written by very smart people asking very interesting questions or raising problems which, to an astonishing degree, continue to be present in the 21st century. I should emphasize three things this book is not. The first thing it is not is a work of American intellectual history in any traditional sense, because I refer exclusively to Publius. I am frankly not interested in this book, who wrote the 85 essays. You will learn almost nothing about Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, or John Jay. You will learn about a fictive person called Publius. Imagine a fictive person called Ishmael. And trying to figure out what this fictive person was saying. this allows me, among other things, simply to ignore completely. I'm really not interested in the question of whether the authors of any of these particular essays at any particular moment were sincere. Did Alexander Hamilton believe some of his paeans to democracy? Or, you know, one can say the same thing about Jay or Madison and other essays. It's a very interesting question, but it's not a question that this book raises. Rather, it is about what Publius was saying, and then taking the essays, quite frankly, out of context. Again, one American cultural historians, intellectual historians, would be very interested in the particular context that explains some of these essays. The most important context is that Publius was trying to get the wavering votes of anti-federalists in New York, and ultimately the convention was ratified, the New York ratifying convention, by the grand vote of 30-27. So it was really important to persuade the waivers. But that's an historical factoid. It is not a reason for you to read The Federalist or, frankly, for you to read my book. Rather, if there is a reason for you to do either, it is because there's something in it for us today to think about these essays. So what else is this book not? I've mentioned one thing it's not, that is a traditional work in American intellectual history. It is also not a book at all about how the Constitution should be interpreted in the 21st century by the Supreme Court. It's not about originalism. My own thesis, which could be the topic for a different lecture, not today's lecture, is that the Federalist has astonishingly little to say about constitutional interpretation in the way that lawyers usually define that term. There's also the independent question of whether we should necessarily be bound by late 18th century understandings of constitutional meaning. Again, that's the topic of many, many other lectures. But then that leads to the third aspect of the book that's important. It is obvious that I have come to believe that it is worth our scarce collective time to read actually all 85 of the essays. But it's not because I view the Federalist as a fount of necessarily of wisdom. That is, to read the Federalist in order to come up with answers for our time, where the argument would be, if it's good enough for Publius, it's good enough for me. That one of the things one would discover inevitably is that one disagrees with one or another of the essays. One of the things one discovers about some of the essays that I won't be talking about today, I'm going to focus, given our limited time together, on three of the essays out of 85. So I'm not professing that it's a representative sample, but it is three essays that I think are particularly interesting for 21st century people. But you'll also discover that the First Congress made decisions very, very different from what Publius had guaranteed the Constitution would mean, or the Supreme Court, John Marshall, freely ignored Federalist 33, it turns out, when deciding probably the most important single case in American constitutional history, that is McCulloch versus Maryland in 1819. So this is not meant to be a reverential book. It is, to repeat myself, based on the notion that these are really interesting people. They were not professional political theorists, but they were very, very smart people engaged in the politics of their time. And because of the drama of replacing what they called an imbecilic political system under the first Constitution that we almost never refer to because it's an embarrassment, that is the Articles of Confederation that lasted from 1781 to 1787. The 1787 Constitution was designed to replace that imbecilic system, and they believed it needed to be replaced. So you had a very high-pitched politics where you had genuine patriots, and I must say, whatever one thinks of Alexander Hamilton's policies, which continue to be controversial 225 years after his service in government, there can be no doubt, I think the play is absolutely correct, that he was a man of public honor. And one of the remarkable aspects of the play is that he chose to confess publicly to his affair with Maria Reynolds, because that spoke to the fact that he was capable of private dishonor and shameful conduct. But that's different from public corruption. And it was absolutely central to him that he was always focused on the good of the country, whether or not you agreed with his particular answer. So let me turn now to these three quotations. It happens to be the case, incidentally, though I really am insistent on referring to Publius, but it's a happy accident, as it were, that these three quotations were written by Hamilton, Jay, and Madison. And say, I really don't know that it matters. But let me begin with the very first paragraph of the very first Federalist. And the format of my 85 essays, which quite obviously each one is short, the way that each of the 85 Federalist papers is relatively short, almost nobody except graduate students who are assigned the Federalist sits down and reads them straight through. One generally consults the Federalist if you're interested in particular topics. And so the format is to pick out certain aspects of each of the essays and then reflect on, okay, what does this have to do with us in the 21st century? And so the first quotation, it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country by their conduct and example to decide the important question whether societies of men, or today we certainly add women, are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force. Incidentally, my suspicion is that if you gave this quotation out of context to people and said simply, this was written by a famous founding father, guess who it was? My hunch is that a lot of people would say Thomas Jefferson, and would say so altogether reasonably, because this is suffused with a certain kind of optimism about popular judgment, something we do not associate with Alexander Hamilton, who is in fact the author of Federalist One. So the question for us today is whether we actually believe this ourselves. Was reflection and choice about the most fundamental issues of governance something that for one reason or another could be done in 1787-88, but can't really be done today? You might believe there were giants in those days, the cult of the framers. You might believe, well, actually, the people who are being referred to are a very small subset of the general population. Most people in this room today probably would not have been counted as part of the relevant people in 1787 with regard to engaging in reflection and choice. You obviously begin with gender. Even if I add women, they certainly meant men. And so the electorate was a much, much reduced electorate. And there are some people who believe this is very important, even in 2016, who would say there are just too many people who are allowed to participate. And that's not a completely frivolous argument. Democracy, there are good reasons that democracy has been a controversial theory of government for some 2,500 years. And that the framers themselves would not, by and large, have described themselves as little D Democrats. They would have described themselves as little R Republicans because they were afraid of Democratic rule in some case. So the question is, do we share that fear? Do we believe, well, this engagement in reflection and choice, that was good at that time, but God forbid that we should genuinely try to inculcate a feeling among the general electorate today that we slash they are capable of the kind of reflection and choice that, among other things, was willing to say that the existing system of government was imbecilic and that it needed to be replaced by a radically different form of government. You should know, and I won't dwell on this in my remarks today, but you should know that what probably makes me distinct in the legal academy is that I want a new constitutional convention. That I think there are many, many ways in which the 1787 Constitution is defective and helps to explain why most Americans today, regardless of your place in the political spectrum, are extremely upset and have lost a certain faith in the national government. But I know that most of my family and friends believe that this is crazy. That is to think that we could or should have a new constitutional convention because, frankly, there is no confidence in our shared ability for reflection and choice. The first thing I hear over and over again is you can't really want Americans of today to engage in reflection and choice about how we ought to be governed. We ought to accept and indeed to venerate a constitution which in some sense is a constitution through accident and force. That is to say, it was not the case that everybody in Philadelphia in 1787 came to a decision that this was really the perfect constitution. There was wheeling and dealing. There were compromises. The most notable ones involved slavery, which nobody, I presume, would defend today, and a system of representation in the Senate that gives Wyoming the same power as California, which I assume that very few of you would wish to defend today. So this was imposed on us because it was viewed as the lesser evil than having small states like Delaware walk out of the convention and condemn us to being two or three countries along the Atlantic coast. The other lecture that is taking place even at this moment at the Commonwealth Club has to do with British secession from the European Union. There are overlaps in these two topics because the central issue posed in Europe today is whether or not there is a genuine reflection and choice to amalgamate into what someday will be a United States of Europe with far more central control than each of the so-called sovereign countries within the international order, or whether actually Europe will dissolve, beginning with the exit of Great Britain. That was a fundamental issue in 1787. If you read the early Federalists, it's all about the need for coming together and to make compromises, including quite terrible compromises, in order to come together. But the basis was this confidence in reflection and choice. And so for a 21st century audience, the question is, do we share it? Now, you might say, okay, I don't share it for new constitutional convention. You are crazy if you think we ought to do that. But then a constitutional convention is a little bit like the canary in the coal mine. Because if you really are fundamentally suspicious of the ability of Americans to come together and have a serious discussion about basic issues of constitutional governance, why do you think that the upcoming November election should be viewed as deeply legitimate? And I'm not talking simply in terms of issues of voter suppression or the role that money plays in politics and the like, but the much more fundamental issue that, for better or worse, our election system is predicated on the notion that people are capable of reflection and choice about who should be president, who should be governor, who should be senator. Well, why do we think that? And if we do think that people are capable of engaging in serious reflection and choice about who should become president, then why do you doubt their ability to engage in reflection and choice about whether we ought to have a presidentialist system of government rather, say, than a parliamentary system, or looking at many of the other specific features of the 1787 Constitution that I would argue in a quite different lecture do not serve us well in the 21st century. In any event, this is why the very first Federalist, I believe, is as relevant in 2016 as it was when it was published in 1787. The second quotation happens to have been written by John Jay. Again, I'm satisfied to talk about Publius. I have often taken notice that Providence has been pleased to tie this one connected country to one united people, a people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same religion, attached to the same principles of government, and very similar in their manners and customs. The first thing that one should say is that this is absolutely preposterous as a description of America in 1787. And here I will talk briefly about John Jay, because John Jay was a New Yorker, and already in 1787, New York was an unusually cosmopolitan city. Indeed, the Constitution was translated from English to German and Dutch within a month after September 17, 1787, because as Jay had to know, there were lots of Dutch speakers about 40 miles north of New York City. There's a reason, after all, why the original name of New York was New Amsterdam. He also had to know that roughly a third of Pennsylvanians spoke German, much to the unhappiness, incidentally, of Benjamin Franklin, who might have been cosmopolitan in many ways, but this wasn't one of them. So why did an intelligent, sophisticated man write such nonsense? The answer, I think, is because it was viewed as necessary to the constitutionalist project, to ratification, to accepting what was, after all, as the critics of the Constitution correctly pointed out, a consolidationist government that replaced the imbecilic Articles that had a ridiculously weak national government with a very strong national government. And so part of the sales job, and there should be no doubt whatsoever that the Federalist is a brilliant piece of propaganda instrumentally written to achieve a purpose, that is ratification of the Constitution, and to overcome the doubts of the wavering delegates in New York, the wavering delegates in Virginia and elsewhere, that made ratification touch and go. So this was thought to be helpful to the project, as for that matter, was the opening line of the Declaration of Independence. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to separate. Well, in what sense were we one people in 1776? Let us count the ways in which we were multiple peoples in 1776, we were multiple peoples in 1787, and even more so in 2016. Are we multiple peoples who are not descended from the same ancestors, do not necessarily speak the same language, certainly do not profess the same religion, and are only waveringly, if at all, attached to the same principles of government and very similar in our manners. Now, is this relevant in 2016? One of the arguments I make in the book, I tie this to the final book of a very important political scientist at Harvard, Samuel P. Huntington, whose last book, quite frankly, was very Publian, who quoted from Federalist II and bewailed the fact, in particular, that as a result of remarkable immigration acts passed in this country in the 1960s and against the 1980s, there was an influx of immigrants, particularly from Latin America, who were speaking Spanish. And Huntington thought that was a very bad thing and that we needed to work very hard on achieving a greater similar American identity. I don't share that view, but I do think it's an important view that needs to be argued out. And I would also argue that there is a linkage between Publius in 1787 and Donald Trump today. Donald Trump certainly does not write with the elegance of Publius. But what one can see in some of the nationalism of Donald Trump is precisely this fantasy that we ought to be more like one another and we ought to mold our policies in all sorts of ways to assure a greater singular identity. This issue has not gone away. It's not going to go away, in part because it is a serious issue worth arguing about. How pluralistic, how fragmented can any single society actually be and still be thought to be a single society capable of some kind of genuine collective governance where the decisions of majority will be viewed as legitimate? There's nothing silly about this issue. There's no reason to think that we've really come up with completely satisfying answers. One of the arguments I make throughout the book is that if you accept some of Publius's arguments about the so-called extended republic, that is, he rejects the view, and this that you can have a so-called republican form of government only in a relatively small and homogeneous country or homogeneous state. Number two, actually, of course, is very homogeneity-oriented. But what he says falsely is that the whole country, from Massachusetts down to Georgia, is all alike, which was preposterous. So it was also preposterous even to say that New York was that alike. But if you really do take seriously the idea that we can be one jointly governed country in 2016 when we have 316 or 320 million people today extending from northern Maine to the middle of the Pacific and, depending on your theory of Puerto Rico, into the mid-Caribbean, then it really does become a very serious question of why stop here? Why not move, for a variety of reasons, to some much more extended form of transnational and indeed even world government. After World War II, there were actually people interested in world government, and one of the utopian visions of the United Nations is that it would ultimately become world government. This obviously is the central issue of the EU. Whether this band of very different nations can come together in a transnational government. And so are we at the Goldilocks point today that we're just the right size? Or could we, in fact, be much larger? Now, the other response is we're way too large, and it would, in fact, be better in the 21st century, perhaps, if we became three or four separate countries under some theories. But again, the issue of size and the history and the theory of homogeneity and pluralism are recurrent issues, and Publius really does ask very important questions, whether or not you happen to agree with not only his demonstrably false description of the way we were, but much more importantly, why he felt impelled to offer this picture of homogeneity as part of the argument for the United States Constitution in 1787. The last quotation is from Federalist 41. It happens to have been written by James Madison. My hunch, again, is that I simply distributed it to people and said, this was written by a famous founder. Indeed, I'll give you a better hint than that. It was written by one of the co-authors of The Federalist. Who is it? My hunch is that almost everybody would say Hamilton. Because it bespeaks a certain view that is often associated with Alexander Hamilton. But it's not. It's James Madison. It is in vain to oppose constitutional barriers to the impulse of self-preservation. It is worse than in vain because it plants, it plants in the Constitution itself necessary usurpations of power, every precedent of which is a germ of unnecessary and multiplied repetitions. Now, if this doesn't scare you, I don't know what could. And there it is in the Federalist Papers. One of the things that I talk about in the book is that the State Department sends copies of the Federalist around the world, especially when countries are in a process of constitutional transformation. Perhaps they've overthrown a dictator or otherwise thinking of redrafting the Constitution. And for some reason, the State Department thinks it will be really, really helpful to read The Federalist. Now, actually, I think it might be helpful to read The Federalist, but not in ways that I suspect the State Department believes. My hunch is that members of the State Department, like most Americans and most of my colleagues, have either not read The Federalist in its entirety, or if they did so as undergraduates many, many, many years ago, and prefer, when they think about The Federalist, to think of number 78, which talks about the rule of law. And I think that what the State Department believes is that people who read The Federalist will come out of it with an admiration for the notion of the rule of law, for constitutions that will limit government, and this is a wonderful thing. And, of course, it might be a wonderful thing. But then you come to number 41, which informs us that it is in vain to oppose constitutional barriers against the impulse of self-preservation. Again, you might think of Donald Trump in this context. Madison often referred to what he called parchment barriers in the Constitution. In fact, this was the basis of his original opposition to a Bill of Rights, promises are made to be broken, basically. And they will be broken if you believe that the reasons for breakage are strong enough. And what could be a stronger reason than the impulse of self-preservation? So you mentioned korematsu, and the fact there will be a talk on korematsu. That's the perfect example that the korematsu case was a disgrace. And indeed, even during the Reagan administration, the national government apologized for rounding up 120,000 Japanese resident aliens and Japanese American citizens under the panic and pressure of World War II. And of course, it's important to be reminded that Earl Warren was an avid supporter of the detentions in what one justice of the United States Supreme Court called concentration camps. But the Supreme Court upheld this, and they held it basically because self-preservation was at stake. And when self-preservation is at stake, you give wide, wide latitude toward the military. And indeed, the suggestion here is that if you put in a constitution certain ostensible barriers against governmental action, they're not going to be adhered to. Because what we want out of political leaders is a willingness to do what they think necessary. This is scary, and it is especially scary this particular election season, given one of the candidates for national leadership and his own particular views of what is necessary to do in the name of self-preservation. But there are two ways of responding. One is to say that he has absolutely terrible judgment in every conceivable way and ought to be rejected on those grounds. The other reason is to say, oh, we can't even think of violating certain kinds of constitutional norms because, let justice be done though the heavens fall. Well, what one discovers that even among professional philosophers, there are relatively few people who believe that justice always ought to be done, even if the heavens will in fact fall. But at least there we're talking about fundamental justice. We're not talking about what might be somewhat arbitrary limits on a national government, where what the national government wants to do in the name of national security arguably is just and not unjust, but alas, it's prohibited by the Constitution in one way or another. But what this particular passage suggests is that what we will want out of wise national leaders is a recognition when fundamental interests are at stake and a willingness to do whatever it takes to protect those vital national interests. In the 20th century, 21st century, we sometimes refer to existential threats. And then, of course, we can get into very extended and valuable debates about what really count as existential threats. And my own view is that we tend grotesquely to exaggerate what are existential threats as against mere threats. But what do we want leaders to do if we should believe there are true existential threats? And what does Publius seem to advise? And as I say, the advice is not necessarily to get out the rule book and do what you think the rule book suggests that leaders should do. Let me make just one much shorter point. There's no quote to go with this, but it does demonstrate some of the paradoxes in the State Department sending the Federalist around. Nobody ever reads Federalist 11. It's on nobody's list of greatest hits. Federalist 11, though, is really, really interesting because it says, look, we're an up-and-coming country in an international system that doesn't basically wish us well. We're surrounded by lots of large countries and navies. And if we want to make our way in this world, we have to build a strong national defense ourselves. We have to build a Navy. Well, imagine sending the Federalist across the world to Chinese readers. What the State Department no doubt hopes is that the Chinese will read Federalist 78 and support a strong independent judiciary that will enforce the clauses in the Constitution at all times. Yeah, maybe they will read 78, but they'll also read number 11. And they will quickly realize that China is a rising power against a history of exploitation by lots of other powers in the world, and that if China is going to make its way in the modern world, which is a quite terrifying world in many ways, and there are other things I could read in which Publius is very well aware of terrifying aspects of the international world, that the Chinese should be busy building up their own defense. So if you want to understand why the Chinese are busy putting naval resources in the South China Sea, you could do much worse than reading Federalist 11, because we have the belief that that the Federalist Papers refer kind of only to the United States, and it's certainly true that that's the focus of the audience. They weren't written for an international audience. But for better and maybe for worse, they have developed a certain kind of worldwide audience. And as all of us know, any text can take on different meanings depending on who's reading it at what time. And there are aspects of the Federalist, including this and including Federalist 11, that can take on very, very different meanings from what the American Bar Association or the U.S. State Department might believe when they send copies of the Federalist around the world. In any event, I hope that I've piqued your curiosity in my book, but also in returning to reading the Federalist, not out of some belief that, you know, you ought to know about more about American history. Life is short. But because these papers really do continue to have challenges for us today, and sparring with Publius, who happens to have been Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, is not a bad way to spend your time with regard to thinking through some really vital issues for 2016, whatever the importance may or may not have been for readers in 1787, most of whom were completely unfamiliar with the Federalist. If they read any of them, they would have read just a few published in a few newspapers. But we have access to the whole collection and can ask what's in it for us today. But at this point, let me stop, and I will gladly take any comments or questions.
Our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Professor Levinson from the University of Texas speaking about his book, An Argument Open for All. Time for questions.
Thank you for coming, Professor Levinson. It's a particular privilege to have you here. You've mentioned Donald Trump twice during the course of your discussion. So in fairness, let me approach a question on the other side of the street.
Sure.
I believe the Federalist talks about the dangers of factions, mm-hmm. And the need to try to remove factions in the service of a federal government, talking initially about states versus a federal government. Let me just sort of bend factionalism a little bit, and you got to it in your discussion of the negatives with regard to the paragraph from Federalist 2. What about the political correctness of supporting factions in the country today by the other party? And what are the relative merits, and what, in particular, what are the relative dangers of becoming a factionalist-oriented society?
Oh, sure. It's an extraordinarily important question. Probably the most widely read of the Federalists is number 10, which is rightly famous for its critique of faction. And factions are defined as groups of people who are not committed to the common good, but are committed to their own selfish interests. And so I defined that in an earlier book that I wrote as the Madisonian anxiety, because Madison wrote number 10. And so the question is there a way really of resolving that anxiety? What one can say descriptively is that one of the consequences of the New Deal was to accept what most political scientists would call interest group liberalism, and both parties. This is not simply a description of the Democratic Party, but rather that national politics, state politics, becomes a struggle among a collection of factional interest groups who contend for the coercive power of the state in order to, the most skeptical and depressing vision of this would be to contend for the coercive power of the state in order to line their pockets, what economists call rent-seeking. And there are different examples from both the left and the right of rent-seeking. My wife and I are writing a book together on the Constitution for teenagers, and one of the examples we will offer kind of derived from the structure of the Constitution is what I think is an indefensible agricultural policy. Think of ethanol subsidies supported by politicians of both parties because the upper Midwest collectively, I think if you add all of the upper Midwest, maybe they might be a third of California's population. But it doesn't matter because they have, again, depending on what states you allocate to the upper Midwest, they have 12 to 20% of the votes in the Senate. And that's very convenient if you want to pass certain sorts of farm bills. And so I think it can legitimately be said. I mean, what Democrats and Republicans say about each other is that they're controlled by different interest groups. And depending on what party you're in, you will describe the interest groups of the other side as mere factions, when and your own groups as devotees of the public interest. There are, I think, an increasing number of people who are inclined to say a plague on both of your houses, that it's interest group politics all the way down. So my critique of Trump, to be frank, has much more to do with his character than each and every one of his ideas. I actually published something in several Texas newspapers earlier this week talking about Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, and Donald Trump, because I think Trump is very, very much like Aaron Burr. And I think that part of the dramatic conclusion of Hamilton is Hamilton's support of Thomas Jefferson for the presidency in 1801. And it's not because Hamilton had converted to Jeffersonianism. It's because he thought that Burr was a completely untrustworthy scoundrel, motivated only by a search for individual glory and power, and that people devoted to the public interest would not put a man like Burr in office. But it does seem to me that American politics are certainly deserving of the kind of critique that I gather you would give, and that the kind of the stock defense of interest group pluralism is less and less convincing to many, many people. And one of the issues I would like to see debated at a constitutional convention is, well, is there a genuine alternative to interest group pluralism? But we're not having that discussion because it's easier to denounce the people on the other side, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or a Libertarian, and say that they are scoundrels, whereas we are pure, and not to discuss adequately the kind of constitutional system we've got, which from my perspective has way, way too many veto points that will allow almost each and every faction to prevent what could possibly be viewed as necessary legislation wherever you are in the political spectrum. We might disagree on what the necessary legislation is, but I think that one of the things that explains today why Congress has something like a 12 to 15% approval rate and why most Americans believe the country is going in the wrong direction is because wherever you are in the political spectrum, you're not likely to be confident that the national government will step up to the plate and respond adequately. And Donald Trump is, to some extent, speaking to those fears, but not only to those fears.
You mentioned a couple of times that in reading The Federalist, you have to kind of look at it not so much from the point of view of what their position was, but what they were seeking to do, which was to convince these legislatures, especially the one in New York, to approve of this new constitution. For instance, you mentioned that Federalist 1, written by Hamilton, could have been written by Jefferson, at least the phrase you had in there. The question I'm asking is, and that intrigues me, is that a good lesson for today, that sometimes some of these politicians should be looking not necessarily from the ideological standpoint of what their position is, but from the position of how to get actually something done?
Oh, sure.
And
sure.
Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, I mean, one of the things you discover in a number of the essays, and, you know, I'm only talking about 3.5, that is 1241 in the offhand mention of number 11 with regard to Chinese naval policy. But one of the themes that comes up over and over again is the need for prudence, the need for compromise. Madison, it happens to be Madison, in Federalist number 62, never defends equal voting rights in the Senate, other than to say it's a lesser evil. And politicians have to know when to make compromises. If Madison himself was tempted to walk out of the convention over this issue, and he didn't, because he thought the most important thing was to get a constitution, get the unity. And so he made compromises. And this comes up over and over again. There are several essays, I think it's 36 and 37, it might be 37 and 38, in which he castigates perfectionists who say the Constitution isn't perfect, and therefore it should be voted down. It's, of course it isn't perfect. Why would you expect it to be perfect? We were doing the best we could to face the challenges before us, and that's good enough. And then he went on to say, in my favorite single paragraph in all of the Federalists is the conclusion of number 14, where he says, it will be up to future generations to learn the lessons of experience and make the Constitution better. And what depresses me is that we rarely talk about what the lessons of experience might be and what sorts of things we might need to do in order to make our constitutional system better. But I think this was a major, major point. The best is the enemy of the good. And the task before Publius in 1787 was to get us out of the imbecilic Articles of Confederation and to accept a distinctly imperfect but nonetheless far better constitutional order than the one we were living in.
Thank you, Professor. A question I had is, you talked about a constitutional convention and perhaps revisiting the entire process. I would suggest, perhaps quite silly, but that this room might be a group that might participate in a constitutional convention. People who are interested, they've come to the talk, and an analogous to a convention. And yet, if you look at Federalist 2 and talk about the people descended from the same ancestors, speaking the same language, professing the same, you look in this room, with few exceptions, it is that. So why is the process perhaps still being run by that Federalist 2 description?
Well, that again could take us into a much, much longer discussion. One of my favorite aphorisms, which I always assigned to political science in the 1960s, named John Roach, though I've never found it in print. I would swear under oath that I heard him say this at an American Political Science Association convention in the 1960s, where he said, it's not power that corrupts, it's the prospect of losing power that corrupts. And I think that's a very profound truth, because I think a recurring theme in American political history is the struggle by elites, or the masses, the elite, the particular masses the elites might represent, their fear of losing power with the introduction of new groups and new elites. I was at a wonderful dinner a couple of evenings ago, and somebody was saying, why can't we be more like the United States of the 1950s, when Eisenhower, a Republican, worked very, very well with Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat, and some important things happened during the Eisenhower administration, even though we had so-called divided government. Well, you know, there are lots of answers that could be given to that, some of them having to do with the personal character of Eisenhower, who did not come out of a political background, but came out of a very distinct military background. But it's also the case that the world I grew up in North Carolina, in the 1950s, was entirely different from the world today, particularly with regard, quite obviously, to race. The most magnificent achievement of the Voting Rights Act, of the Lyndon Johnson administration, was the Voting Rights Act of 1965. It is said that when he signed it, or perhaps when he signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but certainly when he signed the Voting Rights Act of 1965, that he was destroying the Democratic Party that he had grown up in. And he was absolutely correct. 50 years later, the Voting Rights Act made possible the election of Barack Obama. But the Republican Party today is a very, very different Republican Party from the Republican Party of 50 years ago, the Democratic Party. There are today no Democrats in the House, the Senate, or the Supreme Court to the right of any Republican in the House, the Senate, or the Supreme Court. You know, similarly, there are no Republicans in the House, the Senate, the Supreme Court, who are to the left of a single member of those branches of government. We are considerably more polarized. Again, to return to Donald Trump yet once more, one of the things he is playing on is that perception of the loss of political power, particularly by whites. By straight whites. I wouldn't leave sex and gender out of this, straight white males. And we have always had these huge issues. Many of Publius's Federalist friends were appalled at Andrew Jackson, and they viewed as a barbarian, and the extension of the suffrage in the 1820s and 1830s. We have always had fights over who can vote, who can run for office, who can participate. And it's not surprising that we continue to have these fights. And of course, the more we're a genuinely pluralistic country where more and more people and more groups are really included within the polity in a way that they certainly weren't when I was growing up, then it's no surprise that you're going to have much, much more very bitter cleavage over these fundamental issues. So that my own view is that the worst decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in recent years is the Shelby County decision that gutted the Voting Rights Act. There are a number of ways you can describe it, but one of them is five Republicans against four Democrats. Now, there are other, say, there are other ways of describing that, and you can say, you know, five people who are sincerely committed to a certain view of preserving the wonders of American federalism. Though going back to the earlier question about factions, one of the things that is so crucial about Federalist 10 is that there is no document in American history that is more critical of states in our entire oeuvre, because for Publius of number 10, states were cesspools of factions, and because they were so much smaller, it would be very easy for a faction to take over a state, whereas the Madisonian hope, or you can say the Madisonian illusion or delusion, is that if you shifted the venue to a much larger extended republic, it would become difficult, one hopes even impossible, for factions to take over. But of course, Madison wasn't thinking of a party system and a way of organizing national politics so that factions could in fact take over as a result of winning elections. And that's why your question about factional government really is so central. But quite obviously, this is what they were talking about in 1787. They thought they had come up with certain sorts of solutions. Some of it had to do with the extended republic. Some of it had to do with the civic virtue, the character of leaders. And again, this comes back to a very central question today. In addition to policy views, what sorts of character do we demand of our political leaders? Whom do we trust? I didn't like the ad in 2008, the 3 a.m. in the morning ad that then-Senator Clinton ran against Barack Obama. But it was getting at the notion that at least on occasion presidents are going to have to make very important decisions more or less on their own. Or at the very least, we're going to have to rely on their judgment and the judgment of a relatively few people, because time will be of the essence. There won't be any opportunity to have a grand debate in Congress. And this could be national security. This could be a financial crisis. I mean, there's a very interesting literature now on the decisions made basically by Hank Paulson and Ben Bernanke after Bear Stearns and then Lehman Brothers, where frankly they didn't particularly care about what the law allowed them to do. They were trying to save, they viewed the entire economy as under an existential threat and believed that their job was to do whatever was necessary. And one might well believe they did a reasonably good job given what they were up against. But one might also say we were very lucky to have people like Bernanke and Hank Paulson. Again, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, you could say that they had the requisite character and that this was one of the things that Publius relied on. And it's very, very much a central issue in the politics of 2016. My own view is that we overestimate grotesquely the importance of 20-point programs on health care or whatever, because the way the American system is geared to work, no president can actually impose a 20-point program on a Congress that doesn't really agree. But there are times, military policy might be one of them, financial crises might be one, public health crises might be another one. Think of Ebola, think of Zika virus, where we really don't have time to have debates over 2 or 3 months on what we should do if we're faced with potential pandemics like the Spanish influenza of 1919 that killed more people than World War I did. And the last of the kind of horror possibilities are natural disasters. Tsunami, or, you know, need not talk about earthquakes in San Francisco, or as we learned last year about Seattle, that those two are occasions where you need people you can trust to make decisions in behalf of the public interest. And there really is no more fundamental question. But there are also many, many occasions where we can, in fact, take time to debate. And then that comes back to the earlier question with regard to the non-existential questions, where we can really debate seriously about what kind of medical care system do we want to have, how many people do we want to cover at what cost, and things like that. At that point, we can have a discussion about whether our current constitutional order will produce the kinds of reflection and choice and then decisions that we either need, or even if you end up disagreeing with the decisions, you can say, well, your side got a fair hearing, and you'll try to organize to throw the rascals out in the next election, secure in the belief that we'll get better policies as a result of winning the next election. So I think one has to talk about basic institutional structures and the consequence of those structures for political decision making. But also, as I say, Publius was very, very concerned about character, the character of leaders, and ultimately the character of the individual citizens who were called upon to engage in reflection and choice.
To carry your idea one step further, based on the kinds of people we've got running now and the kind of debates which seem to be only on Twitter, how can we expect to have the in-depth discussions, or where are the people going to come from to have these in-depth discussions? Who's going to lead them?
Right. There is no more important a question, and I wish I had an answer. I was mentioning to George at brunch that I don't carry around a copy of the Levinson Substitute Constitution in my pocket. I have some ideas as to how we might be better off with certain changes. But what I most think we need is a serious national discussion that we're not really having, I think, about what an answer to your question might be. Some people would say, and I don't think you can dismiss these, this is simply silly, that we're much too big, that even if Publius was right in saying we could have the so-called extended republic, he was writing about a country with 4 million people extending from what we now call Maine to the southern border of Georgia and over to the eastern border of the Mississippi. Can that vision of what the Constitution calls a republican form of government really operate in a country of 320 million people as spread apart as we are? Now, there are all sorts of obvious problems with thinking of the dissolution of the United States into, you know, four or five smaller countries. But as I say, this is really what is behind the discussion going on in the other room right now about the possibilities of a genuinely European political system as against political decisions being made by the constituent countries. I mean, the most common phrase, if you Google it, I'm sure it would come up very quickly. The most common phrase with reference to the European Union is the so-called democratic deficit, that the EU is basically run to the extent it's run at all by a group of technocrats who are in no serious way really accountable to the population of Europe, which taken together is larger than the population of the United States, and taken together, it's even more pluralistic than the United States in terms of the number of national languages and the like. And democratic deficits are serious. And how, in fact, does one run a system or create a system that will satisfy a 21st century notion of democratic legitimacy? I don't have a good answer to this. What we do is keep redrawing the bullseye. So we want to say optimistically, the United States just has to be viewed as a model of democracy for the whole wide world. So we will define the way we do it as democratic. And you know, that may or may not make much sense, but it would generate a long overdue discussion if we said, okay, what sort of democracy do we want to be? And are there ways of getting closer to that? We're not going to turn into Athens. We're not going to be one of the Italian republics. Size does matter. But is there a way in a large country, the extended republic, to integrate people who are really quite different from one another into a common political project and an acceptance that some significant percentage of the time they're going to lose in given political debates, but that shouldn't alienate them from the basics of the political order or to lead to really the kind of, I think, very disturbing data that we get today when looking at polling results, quite independently of, you know, whom you might support for president. Because in many ways, those polls are simply building on much more fundamental polls about whether or not you respect Congress, approve of Congress, have confidence in Congress, whether you believe the country is going the right direction. I do not think it is really an occasion for cheer to discover that the only national political institution that enjoys widespread confidence among the American people is the military. I mean, one can say, well, that's better than being fearful of the military. But I think it's really quite frightening when people say, the only people I really trust to be non-factional, to be dedicated public servants, would be members of the military. I mean, we've got to believe in any kind of functioning democracy to have confidence in Congress. And right now, roughly, again, depending on the poll, roughly 65 to 80% of the American public has no confidence in Congress. The president's is something else, but there, frankly, you're simply taking a proxy of political party. So that Democrats right now, like Obama, especially in his waning days, Republicans don't. You know, that, so you know, there's no news there. The congressional data cannot simply be explained away as partisanship. You would expect something closer to the presidential data. It's also the case for the first time in history, the Supreme Court has confidence of less than half of the American public. And that's a sea change. It used to be that the Supreme Court would dependably have the support, the approval, the confidence of 65 to 70% of the American public. Even after Bush versus Gore, overnight, the level of approval by Democrats plummeted, but the level of approval by Republicans made up for it. So before December of 2000, the overall approval rate was about 62%. And in June of 2001, the overall approval rate was about 62%. But now in recent measures, the approval rate of the Supreme Court seems to be somewhere in the 40s and probably going down, in part because for reasons that some of us find hard to fathom, John Roberts is being condemned by Republican candidates for the presidency. And Merrick Garland can't even get a hearing, even though I dare say many, many Democrats probably wish that President Obama had nominated somebody more liberal. But again, this comes back to the point that there's no overlap. So there are no Republicans who could appeal to a Democratic political base, and there are no Democrats who are capable, it appears, of making any headway with Republicans.
First time, aside from the Bush-Gore, that Citizens United had really done a big job on that.
Yeah. Let me say, I think Citizens United is overrated in terms of its actual importance. I'm not a fan of Citizens United, but I mean, Sheldon Adelson announced yesterday that he is supporting Donald Trump and is presumably willing to spend millions upon millions of dollars on that campaign. That has nothing to do with Citizens United. It has to do with other earlier decisions that liberate billionaires to write checks against their personal bank accounts. Citizens United had to do with the issue of checks coming from corporate accounts. And I don't want to say it's had no effect on our politics, but the people who use Citizens United as the myth and symbol for money in politics, I think are getting it wrong. I think in many ways, the most disastrous decision of the Supreme Court in my lifetime was Buckley versus Valeo in 1976, where you had fragmented groups of the Supreme Court rewriting a statute that Congress never would have passed because it would have been insane for them to pass it. But what the Supreme Court did was to declare spending limits unconstitutional, but contribution limits unconstitutional. That is what has liberated billionaires to spend whatever they want out of their personal accounts, running for office or making contributions to certain kind of political action committees. And Citizens United, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing it overruled, but it is really the tip of the iceberg of what is wrong with the way we finance elections in this country.
So thank you very much, Professor. Your question, we don't have a Greek philosopher to walk around with a lantern looking for the honest man, but the 19th century had the mugwumps, which formed a party just to say they're going to vote for the man which was of the better character. Mm-hmm. That was the only thing that they did. Obviously, that didn't work either.
Right.
So thank you very much. And thank you all for coming. And so ends another lecture at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussions.